Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
It's St. Patrick's weekend and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, Big Short and Moneyball author Michael Lewis. We also talk to a woman still struggling 2 months after Storm Eowyn, Brendan Grace's daughter Amanda Grace on her life story, and Brian Dobbo Thompson becomes a rapper. But first up, while all the eyes were on Taoiseach Micheál Martin meeting President Trump in Washington, Michael Lewis came in to us. He's the guy who wrote The Big Short, Moneyball and The Blind Side, and he told us all about his deep respect and adoration for the US civil service. They're the federal workers who do incredible things for society while under attack from a much criticised campaign of reform and cuts in the Trump administration at the moment. He also talked to us about the Irish crash era and his famous Vanity Fair article from 2011. After that, our show was from the Connemara Gaeltacht on Monday, and there we spoke to Maureen Folan, whose house was severely destroyed in the storm in January, over €150,000 worth of destruction. Maureen joined us once again. We were talking to her back in January, and she gave us an update on how life has been for her and how she is still incredibly homeless all this time since. It really astonished listeners that help is so slow to reach her from the state and the council. Then after that, we have the story of Brendan Grace's daughter, Amanda. She told us about life growing up with the legendary comedian as her father and how she faced her own personal battles as well, which began shortly after the family moved from Dublin to Florida. She was an exceptional guest. I think you'll enjoy that. And then to end, our visiting critic, Brian Dobson. Nearly a year since he retired from the news, he came into us, got out of his comfort zone, and he visited the Cabin Crew Studios in Cork City, which is Ireland's young hub for rap music, and Dobbo tried his hand at becoming a rapper, and you'll hear the full recorded song right at the end. Okay, that's everything in the podcast. Into the episode we go. Now, my next guest's brief stint on Wall Street in the 1980s led him to write an expose of the greed and stupidity at the heart of the financial world. He's become the writer of modern capitalist culture and its greed. His books Moneyball, The Big Short and The Blind Side were made into huge Hollywood movies, really blessed with the adaptations. And his latest is a book of essays about civil servants. It doesn't sound like it might make a thrilling read, but such is the genius of Michael Lewis that it is. Welcome to studio, Michael Lewis.
Well, thank you, Oliver. Pleasure to be here.
You're in Dublin. Why are you in Dublin, first of all, can I ask?
Two reasons. My 17-year-old son is looking at Trinity College as a place to go to university. We came here through the summer, over the summer, and he fell in love with it. And I told him, you have to see an Irish winter before you decide you come here. So he's coming. He just came to see the weather, basically. and I'm getting an award from University College Dublin called the James Joyce Award.
Yes, we know it.
I'm glad you do, because no one's really explained it to me.
You know quite a lot about Ireland. We'll come to that later, because you wrote a very famous piece for Vanity Fair in 2011. Yeah. But I want to begin here because you're known for picking the zeitgeist. But you started this whole idea. It's the who is government, the untold story of public service. You started this idea before even Trump was inaugurated. The first time this was in your head.
So not quite. It was in the middle of his, a year into his first term.
Okay.
And he has electrified. You're right. Civil service, who thinks they want to read about it? Normally, it's like writing about, you know, ice melting. But Trump electrified the material. And
yeah.
What he did the first time, and there was a premonition in what's happened here then. By law in the United States, we have a 2.3 million person non-military civil service. It's got to be the most complicated organization on the planet. By law, the outgoing president is required to prepare for the transition. And Obama had deputed 1,000 people to spend 6 months preparing detailed briefings of everything that went on, not just in the White House, but like the Treasury Department and the Agriculture Department. Trump had unbeknownst to Trump, he had a 600-person transition team to go in. The day after the election, he finds out about this transition team and he fires them all. And he tells the person who's head of it, Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, that we're so smart, you and I can figure out the federal government in an hour. And I thought, this is great. It's high comedy. It's like, they're not going to figure out the federal government in an hour, but I can go get the briefings that his people never received. And I almost arbitrarily picked the departments I went into, but one was the Energy Department,
yeah.
which they were saying they wanted to get rid of at one point. And it houses the nuclear arsenal. It manages the nuclear arsenal.
Incredible.
And I found myself getting a briefing from the people who manage the nuclear arsenal, and their tone, their attitude towards me was, it's really great that you came in to get it because they didn't, and it's nice to be able to explain to somebody what we know. It's like what happens when the person in charge of running this vast, complicated enterprise doesn't care about it at all, just neglects it? Because that was the tone of the first administration. The tone of the second administration is very different. It's coming in with intent.
And you're celebrating these federal employees, the civil servants, the work that they do, and the individual effort that can have huge impact on people's lives.
So what I did was I talked five other writers into doing this, and I did it with them, parachuting them into the bureaucracy and said, you're all different. You all have very distinctive voices. You're all kind of famous writers. Go find a story you want to write. It took a nanosecond for each of them to find something they really cared about and produce pieces that were really interesting. And by the by, it ends up being profiles of basically heroes. That is true, with one exception. John Lanchester, one of my friends and one of the writers of this, the Englishman, he chose as his hero the Consumer Price Index. He just wrote a long piece analyzing how complicated it was to calculate inflation and how much we depended on the integrity of the civil service to do it.
Yes.
And how basically, between the lines, how easy it would be for the president one day to wake up and say, oh, by the way, we're not calculating it that way anymore. We're just doing it on the back of an envelope out of my office. And so we no longer have inflation.
You know,
the consumer price index vanishes. That's right. You take these things for granted. You take a kind of integrity to that process for granted. It is you all take this for granted because you do have a permanent civil service that you don't imagine replacing with political appointees. That's what's going on in the States right now, is that Trump wants to fire at least 50,000 of these people at the top and replace them with patronage, with people with loyalists. I mean, the story I wrote, it's very narrow, but in a way ends up being very broad. You know, I grabbed out of a hat the name of a civil servant just because his profile was curious to me. It said Christopher Marx worked as a former coal miner, has solved the problem of coal mine roofs collapsing on the heads of coal miners, which took the lives of countless miners in the last 100 years. I didn't know the problem. I didn't know his existence. I didn't know that there had been a solution. 100,000 coal miners in the United States in the 20th century died, half of them from roofs falling on their heads. The market never thought to solve this problem. The coal mining companies sort of acclimated the working man to a level of risk, acculturated them to it, so that even though they had the technology to solve the problem, there was never any pressure on them to solve the problem. It was just assumed that this was a dangerous job, even though it didn't have to be as dangerous.
And they didn't have the power.
And they didn't. The workers didn't have the power. Mm. It took this researcher in the government to care enough about it and to attack the problem and figure out how you keep these roofs from falling on the heads of people. All the writers found these characters and these people who were doing things that wouldn't be done by the market, that are that mean life and death to ordinary citizens. And isn't it amazing that we've reached a point in our society anyway where the citizens are numb enough to what's going on that they'll allow a president to come in and try to dismantle the operation at great peril to themselves.
And he has the mandate to do it because he's doing exactly what he promised to do. I mean, he didn't hide it from the American people and they continued and went ahead and voted for it anyway.
I don't know about that. Can I push back on that a little
Please
bit?
Please do, yeah.
I don't want to argue with you on your own radio program, but so he did say he was going to appoint Elon Musk to create a Department of Government Efficiency. That's true. Beyond that, they did not elaborate what their plans were. And you could have, if you were hopeful about Elon Musk going into the federal government, the hope would have been he would have brought technologists to look at the system, at essentially the computer systems. I mean, the American government still runs on COBOL. The technology has not been upgraded. So there was a hope. My hope was that, oh, well, he knows technology. He'll do that. He doesn't know about anything else. You know, he knows that's his thing. He's really good at creating startup companies kind of thing, but that's not the same as running a big government institution. But instead he's walked in and he's just taken a sledgehammer to the institutions without, the only rhyme or reason is, it seems to be, it not cutting expense. It's pretty wasteful what he's doing. It's consolidating Donald Trump's authority. It's like eliminating challenges to Trump's authority, while at the same time throwing some red meat at people who think that the government does, you know, like stuff for foreigners it shouldn't do. You know, yes. that kind of thing.
It was a strange place to start.
Very strange USAID. Place to
start. In terms of picking the... Because it's easy to denigrate, isn't it, the federal employees and the big bureaucracy as the deep state and call it what it is. I like the fact that Geraldine Brooks chose the IRS, which she said, I think, was iconically hated institution because what we'd call it the tax man in Ireland. Nobody wants to pay taxes.
So Geraldine, it was very funny what happened. She saw Geraldine came to the project like Geraldine, great Australian American novelist, godmother to my child. I called her up. I said, we called ourselves the Avengers. I said, I need another Avenger, Geraldine. And she said, what are people doing? And I said, well, Dave Eggers, another one. He's doing the Jet Propulsion Lab. And he's looking at people who are looking at the government workers who are searching for life in outer space. She goes, that's so cheap. Everybody knows that they're valuable. She says, I'm going to pick the one that everybody hates. And so I'm going to pick the IRS. And she went to the IRS and she found this character who had essentially exposed pedophile rings and had recovered all kinds of graft and theft for taxpayers and on top of it all was like a black belt in karate and a dynamic character.
Yeah.
So she had, but again, she walked into the IRS and found this story in a second. You don't have to stretch it to find people in our government who are really interesting characters. And the question is why? Like, I don't know if I went in the Irish government, I would find the same thing. Maybe I would.
They probably wouldn't talk as openly as they have in this book.
Maybe. But I think there's something going on. And it's that our government has been bashed by politicians, both sides, mainly Republicans, but both sides, for 50 years. It has no real ability to defend itself. Like, civil servants know that all attention is bad attention. Civil servants know that if you stick your head up, it gets whacked off. And you just lay low and do your job. You don't get paid a lot of money. It's not glamorous work. So who ends up there? And this is what I think the book reveals. People who are very mission-driven, who find some problem they're interested in solving, that can only be solved inside the federal government. And people who are sort of purpose-driven that way, who sort of like, they're like dogs with a bone. I'm going to stop roofs from falling in on the heads of coal miners. They end up being much more interesting characters than, say, your average Wall Street banker who just wants money. It's just like they're after something really important. And may sound like it's hyperbole and like I'm putting it too strongly. In the end, we were writing about people who'd figured out the secret to life, the secret to leading a meaningful life. All these people have incredibly meaningful lives. They're serving other people. And what's going on in our government now is people who serve themselves have taken over and they're attacking people who serve others.
You have this theory, don't you, about billionaires, about super rich people, that there's not much meaning in their lives and they're perhaps furious about people who have a social use in what they do.
You just put it more bluntly and better than I ever did. I don't know if that's my theory, but I do think it's true. And it's just like a lot of random encounters with rich people, that the more money they have, the more their life is about money. You would think the more money you have, the less your life has to be about money.
Problem solved.
It buys yourself freedom. Look what Jeff Bezos just did. Jeff Bezos has $100-something billion, and now he's completely swiveled on whatever principles he's had and is sucking up to Donald Trump. Like, you would think he'd have enough money not to suck up to Donald Trump. But no, in fact, having that much money in some way compels you to suck up with Donald Trump. It leaves you unfree.
It makes them look less powerful, even though it looked like they had all the power. The tech bros.
It's embarrassing.
It's interesting you're saying that because obviously he owns the Washington Post, which published these articles to begin
with. Yes, and he's a friend. I mean, I actually know him. You know, I haven't spoken to him, but I like him. I just don't understand what he's just done. I admired him building Amazon. This is incredible. I know that he's no fan of Donald Trump. In fact, just the opposite. So it is, and he does own the Washington Post. Now, this is where you put your finger on something kind of fun. We did this series of articles before the election. Mm-hmm. Like, I started working on this a year ago, and all these things were written without any foreknowledge that Donald Trump was going to be elected and then do what he's doing to the civil service. It's just lucky that it's incredibly timely and we're going to sell a million books in the United States. It easily could have just come and gone as a nice series in the newspaper. But Bezos, at the time, when they came out, loved them. Love them. Like, he was relaying congratulatory notes to me through the editor. And now there are these damning indictments. Each one of these characters in the book stand as a kind of damning indictment to Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And
but at the same time, he might see them as, well, this, there's nothing partisan here. It's a celebration of federal employees. It's nothing pro or anti-Democrat or pro or anti-Republican party.
And he'd be right to.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump has turned him into partisan pieces because Donald Trump has waged an attack on the civil service, across the civil service, and sort of claimed none of it, that it, he's not pointed out to one bright spot. He's not said this is a good thing and these are good people. He said across the way, these are people who are part of a deep state. There's waste, there's fraud, there's corruption, there's abuse, and we're going to get rid of as many of them as possible. And he offered them like a blanket buyout. Come in, get out of here, and we'll pay you to leave. That's how little we think of you.
Did you look for kind of anything to do with waste in civil service? I presume every country, every civilized country in the world has a certain number of people who aren't doing anything in the civil service. And
our civil service is so watched and so monitored that I couldn't take my character out to lunch. He had to pay for his lunch. And they're all terrified of being caught, you know, getting a free lunch. So it isn't waste isn't the right. It isn't corruption that would be one would naturally find. What you do find is inefficiency. That, you know, and it's an inefficiency that's not the fault of the people. It's the fault of the society not paying attention to this enterprise. It's inefficiency that comes from running your computer systems on COBOL. It's inefficiency that comes from both making it really hard to hire new people and hard to fire people. So that it is. There are things that are clunky and kludgy about it, but it's not that bad. And I got to say, if you said to me, Michael, I want you to write a piece about corruption in an enterprise, and I'm going to pick out of a jar one random federal agency and one random American private sector corporation, I would definitely go for the private. It would be easier to do it on the private sector corporation. More likely, people are stealing pencils from the and cheating on their taxes and doing things they shouldn't be doing in the private sector.
Much less regulated and looked at. In fact, even less in the last couple of weeks because a lot of corruption legislation has now been struck out.
The Trump administration is directing their attacks specifically at people who regulate private industry. So, you know, it's like the referees are being cleared from the field.
The article I mentioned at the beginning, which was for Vanity Fair in 2011, you came here, had a look at the absolute chaos going on.
It was so much fun.
By the way, rereading this whole thing over the weekend.
I've never read it. I wrote it.
It was very triggering, I think, for any Irish
person. So tell me, you're going to have to help me a little bit.
Well, I think the summary of your article is you come and you realise, well, Ireland kind of went mad for a while. These banks went completely rogue, borrowed insane amounts of money, mostly from Germany and some trust funds.
Put it into commercial real estate.
Bought the country from each other.
Yeah.
But what you were amazed by in the article is the fact that we had just guaranteed all the bondholders, which we said we legally had to do. It wasn't true, as you pointed out. They said it was for Irish bondholders. That wasn't true either. But the crux of it is that you're astonished about the lack of protest in Ireland at the time as we emigrated out of the place.
That was true. In a funny way, it seems to have done you well. Your willingness to suffer. It's almost like we had this coming to us. We have to pay the price now. We're reverting back to miserable, poor Ireland, and we can just suck it up and gut through it. And apparently you have. When I come here, both before the financial crisis and in the last few years to Dublin, the thing that pops in my mind, this is going to sound strange, but the Boston Red Sox baseball team, large Irish fan base, but the Boston Red Sox, for the longest time, was the losing baseball team. It had this curse on it. For 100 years, it couldn't win a World Series. Yeah. And people complained and they bitched and they moaned and it was horrible being a Red Sox fan. But nothing was so horrible as after when they finally won the World Series and the people didn't know what to do with happiness. They had put all of their misery into the Boston Red Sox and it gave them an excuse for why they were unhappy. And once you won, you didn't have the excuse. I feel a little bit here that way that like, oh my God, you're the richest city in Europe right now. It feels that way. It feels unbelievable.
On paper, at least.
And I assume that your therapy bills are going through the roof because previously you had good reasons for being unhappy. Now you have none. But on the other hand, it does seem happier.
That is pretty much what you're saying in that article from 2011, which was that we went from poverty to wealth so quickly we'd know in between, like the Germans, you know, got time to sit around and consider the world. We didn't. And then we went straight to
And you come right back to it.
Yeah. I suppose when we say we suffered, you could say that the people who made the decisions, they got their lump sums and their pensions and enjoyed them since if they've survived. And there was very little punishment for those who really fanned the flames of what was the pain.
But for me, I wasn't picking on Ireland. It was one insight, and take it. It's a crude insight, but that led me to come here. I had written The Big Short about the American financial crisis. But, you know, you look up and you could see this wasn't just an American, it was a global phenomenon, but that it was different from country to country. A bit like COVID was different from country to country.
Yeah.
I could have done the same thing with COVID, and I wished I had. And that, you know, essentially the root cause was the same as with COVID, that countries were left alone in a dark room with a giant pile of money, and they were allowed to do whatever they wanted with it. And it, people had the different kinks, right?
Yeah.
So one country's yum was another country's yuck.
Yeah.
And the Greeks inflated their state. The Iceland decided they wanted to have the three biggest banks in the world, and that they were massively ingenious traders of financial instruments, and Vikings were born to be, you know, investment bankers kind of thing. And Ireland had its own thing. And so it was more, what does the event reveal about the society?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I was just looking for different sort of experiences. And Ireland was just a stop on the way. Our world, as you cross borders, looks more and more the same. The shops are the same. The food's the same. Although, you know, it's less of a distinctive experience, but you can see that what's distinctive in the culture when these traumas strike. And so that's what interested me. And I came for 2 weeks and I wrote the article. And
it was incredible. If you're only here for 2 weeks, you've got quite an insight. Looking back at it now, it's extraordinary.
Well, I don't know how it reads. I might look like a fool.
It's absolutely perfect. And you might be surprised to learn, because you also write about the reaction in Iceland and Greece, where they toss out their governments pretty much straight away. Even the banks are collapsed, and they start a whole new political spectrum, basically. But in Ireland, you would like to hear that the same party that caused the mess of the place are in power right now.
There we go. There we go. So that's more like us. We didn't even collapse our banks. We didn't do anything that way. And that, you know, if you want to understand Trumpism, the anger, Trump
yes,
is about
the anger is still there.
The anger is still there, and the anger goes right back to that.
Should we be frightened in Ireland about our tax take, because we're reliant on American companies? We talk about big tech a lot, but it's mostly pharmaceutical in terms of what makes us the money.
Should you worry about Donald Trump coming and trying to change your taxes?
Yeah,
of course you should be worried, because he seems to just have a nose for causing trouble, and he's got a nose for any time he senses the Americans are getting somehow a raw deal. That tax money should be our money, kind of thing. However, if you play your cards right, you'll be fine. Lay low. Don't say anything nasty about Donald Trump. Suck up to him when you see him. Send your prime minister over to flatter him.
Oh, we're all about this already.
If you can do that, if you can suck up, if I can hear the sounds of you sucking up from my office in Berkeley, I think you'll be fine. He's going to talk about it, but he might not do anything about it. You are not an obvious target.
We're not high on the list of grievances.
And also, a lot of the thugs around him are Irish. You know, that his posse has got, it's a lot of Irish America.
This is the Irish America we don't talk about here.
You don't?
Joe Biden was Irish, but nobody in the Trump administration.
This just occurred to me. Should we be blaming you?
Exactly, yes.
Should we be blaming you? I it's possible we should be blaming you. But I think...
But all those Bannons, they're gone. They have no influence anymore. I mean, this other Irish name, that was the first administration.
Yeah, so I just think if you lay low, the storm might just pass. And you have friends, right? Presumably the Irish Americans are your friends.
Absolutely. And it's waning. That influence is waning. I mean, Joe Biden does feel like he's going to be the last of the connected Irish American presidents.
Mm-hmm.
There are fewer and fewer, and maybe we're... But of course, things change as much as they stay the same. The opposition in America is quite silent and effete so far, not very effective.
This is a really interesting observation. We should say that I'm like a C-minus political pundit. I don't go on that you're talking to the wrong person to get a fluid answer and a fluid analysis of American politics. I'm just a citizen who happens to write stories. However, what's been interesting to me is Trump has come in and so traumatically disrupted the government. He hasn't. He didn't say he was going to do these things. He's just doing them. And every day there's a fresh outrage to which everybody pays attention. And then the next day they move on to the next outrage. The Democrats were unprepared, clearly, but they don't have the words. They haven't figured out what the words are. Like,
yeah.
What do you say in response, aside from he's breaking the law every day, which is they do say. And I think there's a reason they don't have the words, because the words require you to make a full-throated defense of government, a full-throated defense of the civil service. And they have shied away from that for decades, because it's not a winning. It has not never been winning on the campaign trail. It's like the playbook is Republicans bash government and say they're going to eliminate agencies and say the civil service is the deep state and so on and so forth. And the Democrats just kind of move on to the next subject. They don't agree with them, but they've never been in the position of having to defend the society.
Yeah.
Defend, and this the government is the society.
That's a campaign they need to do.
They need to learn how to do it.
Repeat it.
So they need to learn how to do it. And I had a call, and I could tell you this, that how thin the bench is on this subject, because I'm just a writer, right? I'm not an expert on American government. I've written a couple of books in the American government, but you look at my output. It's about psychologists and money and baseball and football, and I'm all over the place.
Yeah.
I'm not the person to be the voice of this. But I had a call from a congressional committee 2 weeks ago saying, would you please come in and be our expert about the importance of the civil service? This is from the Democrats.
Yeah.
And my reaction was, you're calling me? Like, this is a bad sign that there are so many people who should be voicing this, making this argument. Hmm. And the Democrats should have long ago seeded in the American mind the importance of having a government. The government is just not, it's not people just laying around being lazy. That these functions the government does, taking care of the nuclear weapons, raising, collecting taxes, running the treasury and deciding how to manage the debt.
Saving rural America.
Saving rural America.
That they're in this book.
It's one thing after another. That those functions should have been explained and sold to the American people, and they have not been. So I think that's why they've been in this defensive crouch for so long on this subject that they don't have the words yet. But some younger leader is going to rise up and have the words at some point.
I presume that's your prediction, because you're usually ahead of the posse.
I do. I don't know who the person is, and it won't be. But when they emerge, it'll be very obvious. They'll become the leader of the Democratic Party.
What other kind of thing you can pluck from the ether around the world should we be looking at to happen next? Because cryptocurrency, you were ahead of. You're ahead of, the people who predicted the crash. You were chatting to them before anybody else, including here in Ireland. By the way, that guy Morgan Kelly still hasn't done an interview since then.
Oh, really?
I think you scared him off. But anyway,
I loved him.
Loved him. Yeah, he's brilliant. What should we be looking out for now?
All right, I'll take a stab at this. Though again, I don't think I predict the future. I just pay more attention to what's under my nose. I think that's the way you predict the future. You look under your nose and what's there, and if you just pay attention to it, it'll tell you where we're going. So Donald Trump won. I was waiting for something that happened that didn't happen. I was waiting for the debt to become more of an issue. America's debt,
yeah.
Deficits are getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. We're about to cross the peak reached in World War II in our indebtedness. No voice at all for constraining this in the political system. And Donald Trump is going to cut taxes and he's going to make the problem worse.
Yeah.
So I waited in Donald Trump won for him to get up at some rally in Alabama and say, people say we're in debt. We're not in debt. Who do we owe this money to? We owe it to the Chinese. How did they get it? They stole it from us, an unfair trade deal.
We're not going to pay it.
We're not going to pay it. I waited for that. Didn't happen, but I thought if it happens, it's the beginning of a different kind of financial crisis. The first financial crisis we were all able to dig our way out of because there was a parent in the room called the government. The government come in, the banks behave badly. The government could say, we can actually insure all this risk. Everybody can calm down. When the government is no longer the parent, when the government is a toddler, and there's nothing above the government or bigger than the government, you've got a different sort of problem. So I would point to you, last week, Donald Trump said, these treasury bonds, I've been looking at them. They're not all the same. Some of them are a little squirrely. They don't look real to me.
The doubt is being
created.
Already.
Watch this. What will happen is people will go, oh my God, this is a guy who bankrupted six companies, who has spent his life walking away from debts. Maybe this is why they elected him.
It would make sense.
It would make sense.
And watch, I mean, that's world chaos.
It's world chaos. Yeah. I mean, he'll try to reel it back in if the stock markets collapse. But
yes, as
he does. I think you could cause a lot of trouble there.
Well, thank you for being such a comfort.
There we go.
To talk to
I'm glad. I hope I warmed up your cheered up your morning.
Look, I love that you are moved by these people, these unsung heroes, which are now finally sung in your book, Who is Government? The Untold Story of Public Service, edited by Michael Lewis. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Enjoy the rest of your stay here. Now, that was a lovely way to start this morning. Now, a few weeks ago, you might remember we were talking in the immediate aftermath of Storm Éowyn, literally the morning afterwards. We spoke to Carna native. Her name is Maureen Folan, and she was safe at her son's house during the storm. But when she went back to the house, her house where she lives on her own the following morning, The damage she was met with was incomprehensible. It wasn't far from Ceann Vossa, which is Maes Head, and it was a national weather record where it recorded gusts of 183 kilometres an hour, the weather station there, Maureen's Cottage on the seafront in Weenish, and lost the roof. All the internal ceilings came down. Her whole home was exposed. Well, it's well over a month now since that storm. We wanted to check in with Maureen since we're over here in Connemara and find out how she's doing. Good morning to you, Maureen.
Good morning.
Thanks a million for chatting to
us
again.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us again, because people mightn't remember exactly what all of the roolie-boolie and all the conversations around the storm. Yeah. Like, you were one of the worst affected, really, weren't you, in terms of housing?
The worst, I think, in Ireland, actually.
You've been living in the house how long?
42 years.
42 years. You married there, you had two children.
Yes.
And you were telling us, of course, you lost your husband
That's
very
right,
early on.
That's right, yes, yeah. Correct,
how long were
yeah.
you married?
Well, I was only 13 months married, actually, when my husband was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, terrible, yeah. sad. Yeah. But it puts into context how important this building.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Mm-hmm. And when you went out this morning, because thankfully you were brought to, you went to your son's house.
I know.
Did you go willingly? Or
I didn't, actually.
Did
I
you
wanted
not?
To stay. I thought, well, they always say there's bad forecast coming, but I didn't believe. I said, it's not always as bad as they say. So my son said, no, he said, this is going to be very bad. He said, so you'll just have to come and stay with us, which
and
I did.
You drove back the next morning.
I did. I drove back the next morning. When we got up at their house, they didn't have any light or water, nothing. So I said, I'll go home because I had the old style range. And I said, I will cook breakfast for you and this will keep you going for the day. And I met a neighbour and he said, he stopped me on the road. And he said to me, had you stay home last night? And I said, no. And he said, well, he said, there's no roof on your house.
You didn't believe him?
I did not believe him. Now, I thought it was a joke. So he said, you can't go there on your own. He said, I'll go with you. And he did bring me to see it. So I couldn't believe what I did see.
And you told us you stopped the car on the road.
I did. I stopped the car in the middle of the road. And as far as I know, he took me out of the car. And when I got back into my car, I just couldn't remember how to start the car.
That's how disturbing it was.
Yeah.
May God help you. I'm so sorry.
I know. Thank you.
And it was the 24th of,
24th
January.
Of January, yes.
I mean, people may have seen the photographs. The gable
I'm sure
is down.
The gables
entire
are down,
roof,
yes.
guttering.
Yes, everything is down, yes.
It's destroyed. If you were inside the house, you could have been killed. You certainly would not have got out.
I couldn't have got out because both doors were blocked with the debris from the roof. Mm-hmm. And then there was no phone, nothing working.
Yeah,
couldn't contact anybody.
No coverage.
No.
Where did you stay? What did you do in the days after it?
I stayed with my brother and his wife, which were about 10 minutes away. And I stayed with him for about 3 weeks. And then I got a loan of a log cabin from a good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm staying there since. But I can't stay too long because that's needed for rental.
Oh, yeah. And the tourist season has begun now.
That's right. And I cannot. I just have to find somewhere because the county council have nothing available. Mm-hmm. So I just have to rent privately, I'm afraid.
I was telling people on the way, it was in Clare of the week, and I was saying, we're meeting that woman, and they remembered you.
Yes,
and they said, I hope she got sorted out.
Oh, indeed, not at all.
But what condition is your house now?
It's the very same way.
Nothing has happened.
Nothing at all. It's 6 weeks on. We're
hearing so much about this humanitarian assistance.
Yes, I know, but there's so much needed. I have to get two quotations from registered builders and send all that to them. Mm-hmm. And pictures of the house and whatever. And anyways, it's the assessor really that's holding everything back. Until such time. The humanitarian, when they came to me, they said, we will send you an assessor immediately. Well, that's 6 weeks on and nobody has turned up. I just feel that I'm being neglected and left on the side. I thought my place would be a priority, really.
Yes, because they know that you're.
This is it. That I'm homeless.
You're a woman in her 70s, as you said.
Exactly.
In the press. And you worked, you've done everything you could, everything right. And it's extraordinary because people have been paid out for their freezers and so on.
Yes, of course. Yes, they have, yes.
You're completely homeless.
Homeless and left.
And a woman used to living independently, I'm sure you felt bad going from.
Of course, going from one place to another. And my clothes and furniture, whatever, all that was saved, is in other places. You know, you don't know where anything is. Or where to find anything. Yeah. That's the way it is.
That's terrible upset.
Yes, yeah.
Did you manage to retrieve much
some,
from the house?
Yes. Not all. Not at all. Because, I mean, there was such rain as well and everything was coming down. And at the moment, the place is just a total disaster. Nothing is
dangerous to even go in.
Yeah.
What happens when someone loses their house of 40 years? What do you go looking for when
Isn't
you go
Isn't that
in?
It?
What did you go looking
well,
for?
Well, I applied to the humanitarian and they, I don't know what
no,
they
sorry,
would
I,
give
I
me.
Meant in terms of the sentimental value and the things
inside. Oh, I'm so
your,
sorry. Yes, well, there's been a lot of sentimental stuff lost because right. there was a lake, so well, not too far from the house, and I'm sure most of that stuff has gone in there. Anything that was in the attic just went away.
Of course,
Nothing stayed. Yes.
Did you get your photographs and precious things?
Some of them, not all of them. And the ones I did, you couldn't use them. They were just stuck together, wet and dirty. Yes.
So at the moment, I mean, you spoke to every public representative, government
yes,
and opposition
I did, yes.
in general, and they yes. said that they'd sort out things.
Yes.
Is it the county council that you most want to help you out now, or where is it? Who's at the front line of
it? Until such time, until we get an assessor, I have local reps that are helping and they're trying their best to do what they can for me. But their hands are tied, really, because until the assessor sees what's happening, or sees the place and the disaster, nothing is going to move. And we've been 6 weeks now waiting for him and nobody has come.
And your friends have done everything they could.
They have, yes. And they're willing to help me, but they cannot touch anything until such time as somebody.
Right. So the assessor has to come out and
yes,
kind of
assessor has to come out.
Estimate and how much the
yes,
damage
exactly,
is.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Have people... I actually showed pictures to a quantity surveyor
yes.
and they roughly said, you know, between... up to 150,000, really,
oh,
just to get it moved in.
Yes.
There has been some online funding, hasn't
there? There has, yes. There was a GoFundMe. A friend of my son's was set up a GoFundMe for me immediately, and that worked out great. But that was not going to cover the damage. Because
no, it's even though it's quite substantial, 107,000, but it's nowhere near what you cover, and you've no insurance, as you told us previously.
No, none whatsoever, yeah.
Well, Galway County Council, we've been asking them, actually, in the last few days, to find out what's happening. They said the Housing Department of Galway County Council in their statement initiated contact with Miss Maureen Folan in the aftermath of the storm late January to offer information and advice regarding accommodation housing options available to her. The local authority continues to provide support and advice to Miss Folan on sourcing appropriate alternative accommodation following the devastating damage caused to your home. That's it.
I have heard nothing.
Did they provide you with the accommodation?
Nothing. They didn't provide me with nothing. They just said there was nothing available and that was end of the line.
Continues to provide support.
No,
I don't know what they mean.
Not at all. I don't know what they mean either.
When you ring which is the national helpline on the humanitarian, do you get through to those phone numbers, which is the...
No, the humanitarian said they would... I had to fill up a load of forms and they took them with them and they said that they would provide the assessor immediately.
Right.
But that's six weeks ago and nothing has happened.
And you can't follow up or there's no...
I cannot do anything, no. I mean, the local reps, they're being good to me and they're trying their best, but they have their hands are tied. They cannot do anything either.
What do you think is going to happen?
I just don't know. I hope now when I send in the quotations to the humanitarian that hopefully that something will start to happen.
So maybe if an assessor helped you out or
what
something.
What if an assessor came?
Because it looks like
somebody
in the public system this is not going to happen anytime soon.
Not at all. Because if they even give you the go ahead,
okay,
you'd have plenty of people that would start up for me and help me out. But so they cannot touch anything.
You're relying on the kindness of somebody. Are you in that cabin at the moment?
I am, yes, for another 2 weeks.
The
yeah.
tour season really is beginning.
Yes,
this
is
weekend.
It, you see, and I cannot stay there. So I'll be actually literally homeless. You can't be going from one place to another.
You're holding up very strong, I have
to
say.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
Don't you really? You really are, you know, for someone who's gone through this.
Yeah,
it's just
I know.
Extraordinary for...
Yes, and you know, I have good family and friends, really. They're good.
They're looking after you.
Yeah.
There's messages in from you. Kathleen Tighe, I don't know if you know Kathleen Tighe.
Yeah, I do.
Lacoon of the Day, she says, a lovely lady, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
And someone says, it's 7 weeks since the storm. There's a huge amount of guff about, this is a text from someone, huge amount of guff about the humanitarian fund at the time with the government and opposition parties telling us what would happen. Nothing, not a word since for vast amounts of people. It's not just you, Maureen.
Yes,
forgotten
indeed,
people.
I know so, yeah.
Not a year. That's from Brendan and Roscommon.
Yeah.
And there are people right across that affected region.
Yes, sure.
But it's all about America this week.
Oh,
and,
of course it is.
About
sick listening to that.
Whether a grown man can, you know, conduct himself in front of another grown man.
He can't, I'm afraid. No.
And that's where we are. It's shocking and I think people will be stunned
yes.
to hear
it is, I know.
This
if
far
we just,
on,
if just the government could send out an assessor, that's all we need. And just to get at least we could get a go-ahead or something.
And that assessor would pass on the quote to the fund. And then on you go.
Yeah, this is our problem at the moment.
Finding someone to do the work, of course.
Yes, okay. So I have somebody that would, and have lots that would help out. Mm. But nobody can touch anything until they come and see it.
And by the way, our services are open as well. If anyone from Galway County Council or the government want to get in touch in the meantime, 0870 32 32 32 is the WhatsApp. 51551, by the way, for the text. And the email is oliver@rte.ie. Maureen, thanks for chatting to us again.
Thank you very much.
Good luck. We'll keep an eye on your story. Yes, and hopefully something will happen in Annam J at this stage.
Yes,
Sinead Maid, the Nomad, Bay Maid, Arasharish again, Kupla Nomad. Now, welcome back. On the face of it, our next guest, Amanda Grace, had it all. Two loving parents, an idyllic childhood, trips to Disneyland in the 80s, that sounds great, and even a helicopter parked outside the front door at one point. Her late father, of course, Brendan Grace, one of the country's most beloved, successful, most adored, brilliant comedians. But for his eldest child, Amanda, life wasn't at all perfect, and her troubles began, maybe, we'll find out, when the family left Dublin for Florida. It was around the mid-90s. But she has, thankfully, survived all the woes, and works these days as an inner work mentor, public speaker and podcaster, and all-round person, I believe, full of crack. Good morning, Amanda Grace.
Good morning. Welcome. How are you?
You've lived all around the place, I was reading. Where's home nowadays? Where are you?
I live now in Ballina in Tipperary.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Is that one of those complicated places across the water and it's...
Yeah, on one side it's Tip, on the other side it's Clare, and I've lived on both sides.
Oh, yes.
So don't ask me to choose between them. They're both lovely. They all have lovely bums.
There's more than just one border area than
bottoms.
So that is home. That's and the rest of your family, are they
all
still
in America?
They all live in
America, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. When the whole family, which we'll get into it. And who's in your life now? You're married to Terry?
Terry is my husband.
Lovely husband.
And we live in Ballina. And we had a 16-year-old golden doodle up until last year, Ted.
I know.
Yeah. And my dad used to call him his granddog.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So that's, it's just me and the cat and Terry now.
That's one of the needy dogs, is the poodle. Or was it
a golden doodle.
A golden doodle.
Yes. Right. Yeah. A little bit needy, all right, yeah.
But sad to lose your pet.
Buddy. But we had a great life together.
And Terry's a Leitrim man.
He is.
So Dublin and Leitrim get along.
That's it. Yeah, Dustin was wrong, as it turns out.
So you have a nice existence there on the beautiful waters.
Do you know, I really do, Oliver. It's just such a fabulous place. I have a fantastic community. I'm sure my neighbours are listening as well. And you know, because I texted lots of people and threatened them that if they didn't listen, I'd haunt them. But I'm really, really happy down there. It is home for me. It's the place I've lived in the longest.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
You would have grown up in Dublin. Where in Dublin did you?
So it would have started as an infant in town. And then we moved out to Temple Ogue, and I was there until I was about five. And then we moved up to Saggart. And then from Saggart, the emigration in 94 when I was 18.
18? Right.
Yeah.
Did you want to move to Florida when you were 18?
No, I didn't.
And this is like early 90s. It seems like Florida is the golden hope of everything. Everybody would have.
Well, that's what probably everyone would have thought. But of course, I had just turned 18, you know, and I was like finally of legal drinking age. Not that that ever stopped me before that. But I was, you know, and I was kind of like, I had... I don't know if you'd say a boyfriend, but I had somebody, and I just didn't want to go. I was just having fun, and I was kind of like just doing my thing.
Your whole life would have been here.
Yeah, so I kind of went with a bit of resistance, and I did not make life easy for anybody once I got there, because I went under duress. I was literally put on the plane, like physically put on the plane.
And you're the eldest of the family.
I'm the eldest. Well,
kids.
I'm the eldest of four. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but your existence in Dublin was stunning. It was a great life.
Oh my God, we had the best life. And I've been thinking about it over the last few days, you know, since talking to Caroline and asking me,
Caroline,
you know,
what's our producer, yeah.
Yeah, and what was life growing up like? And it was exciting. Like being in the studios here is just such a nostalgic, it's such a special thing for me. And it's my first time ever to be in the radio studios without my dad. You know,
you would have come in when he was doing interviews and so on.
Oh, yeah, I always tagged along. You know, even as a kid, I'd go to the studios to record his songs, and I'd be sitting with my colouring book and my packed lunch, and he'd be in the studio recording with, you know, Eamon Campbell and all the boys. And I just remember the smells of studio and cigarettes and guitar cases and strings and...
Did you ever go on air with him as a kid, or did you sing with him?
We were on Anything Goes as kids, remember, with
yes,
Angus McAnally?
Yeah, yeah.
And we would have been, I was on Miriam O'Callaghan with him. We were on The Late Late Show. I was on Bebe Baskin when I was 10.
Remember that?
And she spoke to me, Os Gaeilge, on the telly, and I was mortal. I was.
But she's beautiful Irish. So
oh, yeah. And I believe you were in the Gaeltacht there the other day.
Yeah, just yesterday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great time. So it was a real life of showbiz as a kid coming in and the back of theatres, of course, because he toured endlessly and performed endlessly.
I know, yeah. And that's another place. Like, I was in the Nina Arts Centre the other day walking around, and Trish was showing me around and backstage, and just the sound of walking on a stage and the curtains back there and all the wires and bits and pieces. It's just so home to me.
He sounds, both your parents, because Eileen, she's still alive, your mum.
Oh, she is indeed, yeah.
We're really effervescent, really loved people and love being around people and chatters.
Yeah, we're very social people. We absolutely are, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a fun showbiz lifestyle. There was did you see stress along the way because he worked so hard?
Yeah, there was definitely stress. And you know, there was always, my dad was always in an argument with the clock. He was always up against time, you know. And but there was, you know, and he worked very hard, you know, and he played hard too. So, like, there was always a lot going on. But my mom brought the balance to the house, you know. So whatever chaos was going on in, I mean, self-employment is chaos anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, putting yourself out there and like, the labour and the burden of, even though he loved it, to perform and entertain people, it does, it has a cost, you know. But my mum brought all of the grounding to our family.
Did she?
So it was a lovely balance we had.
Did she manage to rein in partying? Because he was a big star of the 80s and like everybody who became famous at whatever level Ireland was, what it was like in those days, it was a party time, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Dad could party with the best of them. But yeah, she'd absolutely put her foot down in the beginning, you know, with young kids in the house, you know, because my dad would be likely to bring people home, you know.
Is that right? Okay.
Oh yeah, she said one time he brought an entire family back to the house and they stayed for 2 weeks and was like, no, there'd be no more of that.
Because he just loved people that much.
Yeah.
He was extraordinarily successful. What was your lifestyle like growing up in the 80s?
We had a great life. We had great holidays. We had the best of everything. We would eat out and just anything that you wanted, you know. We never wanted for anything, put it that way. You know, we had a beautiful house and we had a lot of fun, you know. There was always cars and motorbikes, and at one point there was a double-decker bus parked in the... I used to go up there and smoke. You know, me and my friends used to smoke on...
The double-decker bus?
Down the back by the garage.
Why was there a bus? What was that about?
Did you know me, Dad?
I
don't have enough time.
It was just
a
Fageri happened one day.
Do you know what? He was a big kid. He was just a big kid. Okay. And just anything, like he was quite impulsive as well. And just, you know, if he got an idea, that was it, you know.
It just had to happen.
Yeah.
Was there really a helicopter there at one stage?
There was.
And it was used?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. He wouldn't be flying to the shops in it or whatever, you know, but he'd be going to the races or here and there. But yeah, he bought himself a helicopter at one point.
And it was always nice cars, I presume. And you went to Disneyland, which would be unusual in the 80s, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I read your interview, brilliant interview with Eddie Rowley in the Sunday World.
Eddie is great.
And some great, if money could buy you happiness, it would have been mine.
Yeah.
But of course it doesn't, was the thing you said.
Yeah.
And does your difficulties kind of begin? Do they begin when that move happens to Florida? Because a big uprooting for you.
Well, I guess when we moved to Florida, what started to surface there was the coping that was at play. But before that and all along, there was an insecurity. And there was a, you know, a sense of inadequacy. And I realise now there was just a shame that I had. A lot of it was about, you know, having what I had in life, you know, and in the 80s. And it was, you know, it was quite a contrast to a lot of people around me. And so there was a little bit of that. But then there was always, there was also this kind of like just insecurity in me that I spent most of my life outsourcing the answers to the kind of questions that would keep me up at night, you know, like, who am I? What am I doing? Am I doing enough? Are you mad at me? You know, all those questions. Yeah. And a lot of anxiety as a result, and of course isolation and depression, because I didn't know how to, I didn't even know it was happening. I just thought it was real, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to cope with that in a kind of a bravado way, you right. know. So I kind of became quite rebellious, and I made it my mission in life. You know, it was almost like a badge. I went around pretending I didn't care, pretending I was, you know, invulnerable, all these things. And of course, carrying on like that got me into a lot of trouble, you know.
It's surprising, particularly because home was very stable. And
yeah.
It was a lovely family existence. And yeah. there was security at home.
Yes.
So so you couldn't really, there was no excuse to kind of say, oh, I know what, you couldn't know what was wrong, essentially, could you?
No, I didn't, you know, exactly. I didn't come from anything wrong. And I think that a lot of people do that. I know that the women that I work with now is like, we spend an awful lot of time trying to pinpoint where it went wrong.
Right.
And there may not be a place where it went wrong. Sometimes it's just an idea that you get in your head that you're just not good enough and you believe it. And then you start acting out of that place, you know, and that's what happened to me.
And what happened when you get to Florida? What does it look like? How does it show up for you, this?
Well,
anxiety that's kind of screaming to get out.
Yeah, there was, you know, I was just the acting out was very like I had no communication. I didn't really know how to express myself. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know what my needs were, anything like that. And also, of course, I had lost my friend circle as such.
Yeah,
I was out of context. And I wasn't fitting in very well. I wasn't translating to American very well. Mm-hmm. So I was, I very much went towards the Irish community. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had a great time in Florida, but I partied hard.
Right.
And it was very, and I was underage too.
Yes,
so
of
that,
course.
Yeah, yeah. So that I wasn't impressed by that either, you know. So I just was very like, just unhappy about the whole thing. And then I came home. I just packed my bags and came back to Ireland.
How soon?
Within maybe 18 months.
Really? So you're not even 20? And
about, yeah, I was about 20 when I came home.
Come back on your own?
Yeah.
Really? How did that go down at home?
We still had the house in Sagard at that time. Mm-hmm. So I moved in there. I don't know. Yeah.
Big house on your own.
Yeah, big house on my own. And then my dad would be coming and going as well because he'd have been gigging at home.
Working, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So he was in and out. But and was your relationship, was it strained?
With my parents?
Yeah, when you had left, obviously, Florida, left the whole
family. Oh, God, no. God, no. No, no, not at all. I just decided I wanted to go back home. You know, I was homesick. I was always homesick. Sure, I remember getting homesick in Mexico on a two-week holiday, you know, because I was listening to you too.
Right, and
drunk in the swimming pool at 2 a.m. I was like, no, I want to go home.
Did you know what you were missing?
At home.
As in, yeah, what was the homesickness? What was missing that you needed to go back to Dublin, which you did?
Yeah, I know now, let's say, from where I stand now, that something that's incredibly important to me is connection. Mm. Feeling, you know, and a sense of belonging. And that's really what it was about, you know. And it wasn't just geographic, you know. It was like just feeling secure and settled somewhere, you know.
So you did. You came back. Did you have a plan?
No, I've never had a plan in my life. What's that?
Things go out of control, I suppose, do they? Basically?
Yeah. Well, of course. You know, one of the things that was, you know, my only outlet was having the crack, having fun, and then of course the whole idea of connection and belonging, like. I didn't really have much of a repertoire when it came to how to spend my time, you know.
Right.
So it was really just partying is what I did. That's how I spent my time.
You can find a tribe for that, no doubt.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, you were a very generous partier as well, I think you...
A generous partier?
Yeah, as in you like to give things away and you like to...
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I was very much a party animal and, you know, someone who was good cracked. Like, you'd never know what had happened when I'd be around kind of a thing, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And it wasn't just me. It was, you know, my friends. We were all a bit mad, you know? We were all musicians and we were all into the...
And there was a bit of boom as well in the 90s in Ireland. There was a bit of confidence growing, so...
Yeah.
You wouldn't have looked out of place, would you, enjoying yourself?
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no. It was we were all at it. I had no idea that it was like this was normal. And in fact, anybody who wasn't partying the way I was partying, I thought they were, you know, just a drip or something.
Right, that they were the dry shite.
Yeah, at one point I actually, like I used to proudly declare that I didn't trust people who didn't drink. You know?
You cut your hair off at one stage of the party.
Yeah, yeah, I did. And at the time, you know, looking back in hindsight, it's quite disturbing how something like that would happen. Yeah, I was at a party and there was a guy there that I was, you know, I was into, and I thought we had a thing. And it turned out that he obviously did not share the same, and he took an interest in a friend of mine, and off they went together. And I just was absolutely gutted, you know, but again, did not know how to deal with that. All of the insecurities that it triggered, I basically had a panic attack. And instead of sitting in that discomfort, I took a scissors out of the kitchen press and I just started lobbing my hair off in the middle of this shenanigans as a kind of like, again, it was that bravado. It was like, I don't care. Like, look how much I don't care. And it was just like, at the time, you know, everyone was egging me on and I thought I was great. And it was one of those, it was a distraction, you know, it was just another distraction from my true feelings. And when I woke up the next morning, and, you know, the way it slowly dawns on you, what did I do? And then reaching up to my hair, this hair on the pillow, and I'm going, what the? And then looking at myself in the mirror, and I was just like, I just felt so violated. And I had done it to myself. And my friend at the time was a hairdresser, and I went to her and I was like, God, like, help. And we had to shave my head all over. And she said I took chunks out of my scalp, you know. And it was just like, I had to wear a bandana till it kind of grew back out a little bit again.
What did your family make of this?
Well, they would have been in America as well. So, like, there was a lot that they weren't seeing. And I was also very good at hiding anyway.
Really?
You know, yeah, because I would have probably, some of me moving around so much would have been that running away, you know, running away so that I could be this person out of sight, you know, like, because the people I love were horrified.
Did you know that this was a problem at the time?
No, it wasn't obvious to me at all.
Because people thought you're the gas character who will do these funny things.
Yeah, I thought the problem was me, you know, I thought the problem was just that I was, you know, doing life wrong, failing, you know, and that I was inadequate. I just wasn't enough. But that was a very private kind of a fear and a shame, you know.
Did you have a job at this stage? Did you have a career? What were you doing?
I had several jobs. I worked in hospitality a lot and hotels over the years. At one point then I started flirting with the idea of songwriting. I was songwriting and... But I didn't love the performance aspect of it, but it was the creative process that I enjoyed, and actually it was the self-expression. It was an outlet for me. So that creative thing was always, that was the place where I was confiding, you know. So even though I had all of this like destructive coping going on the outside, but I had a companion. My creativity was kind of there with me all along, and it's the thing that ended up really helping me recover.
I presume because you have successful parents that puts a pressure on you. And if you have an artistic bent in you, basically, you're kind of thinking, can I match that success? Is that the pressure that you think you were under?
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of people do that. You know, we follow a kind of an invisible script or a blueprint, or, you know, there are just like trajectories that we think we must follow in order to be a successful adult, you know. And it's not unique to me, but whatever it is that you think you should be, if it's not for you, you're going to have that kind of conflict, you know. So yeah, I absolutely put a lot of pressure on myself to be at certain, because my father was, you know, successful at 21.
Yeah,
you know, like I think his first number one was when he was 21 or something like that. So that was there too, you know, this kind of like success out the gate kind of a thing, you know.
And decades of it.
Yeah.
So you got lost in the drinking. Did it become really bad? Could you still function? Could you still work?
I was functioning, yeah. I say that now. I don't think I was. Now, looking back, I was not really. Maybe I was barely functioning. But also, like I said, I had gotten very good, as, you know, us addicts do, at hiding the consequences of our behaviours. So, yeah, it got to a point eventually, you know, I turned 40 and then I had a couple of life events that really, you know, crashed down on top of me and really brought all of that coping to a head. And I quit drinking because it no longer felt safe. You know,
how did that come about? How did you know that this was the time?
I had been introduced through an artist friend. So I was doing a workshop in my studio at the time in Sligo, and I had an artist travel over from California to attend this workshop. And while she was there, she said, "I'm going to connect you with a friend of mine."
Okay.
She's also an artist. She said, only she doesn't drink. And I was like, yeah, I don't know why do you think that we'd be friends? You know, because I'm still in my, oh, please, a non-drinker, no thanks. So she introduced us in about December or January. And then that December or January, I kind of went into that new year with a restlessness. And I was like, I was going to do this thing. I had been dealing with an eating disorder for a long time, but I hadn't acknowledged it. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of secretly made a pact with myself that I was going to fix this thing. And so I went into the new year with that in mind. And of course, not knowing how to do that, a lot of the solutions I chose were the wrong ones. But anyway.
And again, that's the dieting thing, because it's the new year's. And you've a very good theory on dieting, don't you? As in its association with gambling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is very much like gambling, because diets work just like horses win races, mm-hmm. you know. And so, you know, that's why we keep going back to them. They win. But we have this bias where we don't see what it's costing us. We don't see where we're losing, you know, that it's ultimately the house always wins, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same deal.
That's I love that insight.
Mm.
That you can get hooked on dieting because you get the odd win, but by and large, it's not working for you.
No, no, the house will always win because you're not changing what's at the very root of the behaviour. You know, why are you turning to food in the first place? You know, that's why is that a solution to your life?
You were having an extraordinary bad run because you also suffered two miscarriages
around the same time. Yeah, so I turned 40. And then I just took it upon myself that I was going to learn how to do this food thing. And then two pregnancies came back to back, lost both of those. And again, just the coping, all of that, like, did not know how to cope with any of this.
Mm.
And that's when the change started. I put the bottle down and I started walking this path, this road of recovery, which was, almost 10 years ago now.
Wow. It's different for everybody. Some people go into actual rehab.
Mm-hmm.
They follow the 12-step program. Did you have a different route or how did you manage to do it?
Yeah, so the lady who I had been introduced to, she had started a podcast and she was sober about 2 years and she's an artist and she's a creative. So I was listening to her as all of this was going on in my world, you know. And she started to paint a picture of sobriety that allowed me to access it, because we all have this idea that you have to be a falling down non-functional drunk to avail of recovery.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know?
That's the Irish bad attitude, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a grey area. And as destructive as my behaviour was, I was still in the grey area because I was still a functioning person who did not look like she had a problem. You know, it was all on the inside. The chaos was all on the inside. And it was just, well, I say it was just affecting me, but of course it wasn't. It was affecting all of my relationships, my finances, everything was affected. But I had normalized that. So listening to her kind of gave me another option. And so that's what I did there. But I was, and because I gave up drinking for safety reasons, I didn't have to white knuckle it. But the patterns were still there underneath and life still had to be lived. And I was still a gambler. You know, in the way that I think about things and play with solutions. And, you know, it was only in the last year and a half that I stepped into the 12 steps and,
oh, really?
And started actually working a spiritual program and getting emotionally sober.
Emotionally sober as opposed to the real thing. What's that difference?
So there's a difference between being abstinent and being sober. Being abstinent, like, is just not engaging with the substance, you know. But being emotional sober is dealing with the patterns that are deep down underneath, you know, like, and questioning those beliefs, changing your attitude, understanding your needs, your values, and actually tending to them, you know, actually looking after yourself, like practicing actual self-care, you know.
It's been an extraordinary couple of years. 10 years sober, congratulations.
Yes.
How do you...
Oh, 8 years, sorry.
Sorry, 8 years. Well, yeah. Congratulations on the 8 years. How do you cope with the... Because obviously motherhood didn't happen for you.
Yeah.
That must have been another thing that you have to...
It was a big dilemma, yeah. And it was something I agonised over for years. I was so on the fence about it, but I know now. And what I learned from that is... What I did learn is the importance of clarity, the importance of knowing yourself, the importance of looking at your motivations. I think that I was reaching for motherhood because I thought I should. You know, right. I think a lot of women think that, you know, it's something that we should want, and you're a bad person if you don't want it.
Right.
And the truth, as it turned out, was that I didn't want it. It wasn't for me. Maybe I would have wanted it if I hadn't got such a difficult relationship with myself. I was at war with my body. Mm-hmm. There's no way I would have emotionally coped with the physical aspect even of pregnancy, given the state of my relationship with myself. So it wasn't the path for me, and I made peace with that. I got clarity around that, and I made a decision, and that was really, really empowering. You know, of course you do grieve. You grieve things that you even voluntarily let go of, you know. But I embraced the possibilities that opened up for me by making that decision. It was like, up till that point, it was like driving with the handbrake on.
Really?
Yeah.
It's kind of constantly in your head.
Yeah, and you're kind of like this hesitancy to go for anything else because you might, you know.
What possibilities open up to you?
Well, I knew that, like, from a vocational point of view, so the clarity that I got is that, like, the only thing that was really attracting me to motherhood was this idea of nurturing and kind of like working with, like, just being involved in the developmental growth of another human being, you know, having the kind of parenting aspect of it. And I realized that I could meet that need through my work as a mentor, as a coach, as a guide, you know. And then, of course, being an artist, you know, I can make babies every single day, you know, like in my studio. You just every time I make a piece of art, it's something birthed into the world.
Are relationships, marriages, are they stronger when you're relying on each other and when there aren't children in the scene, yourself and Terry?
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't know any different, yeah, you know, yeah. But I imagine.
You hear it sometimes, you know. That.
Well, I imagine that there would be stressors, you know, and an awful lot more cooperation involved, you know. So we're very independent of each other, you know, in terms of like there's not an awful lot that we have to agree on, and therefore there's not an awful lot we have to fight over. Do you know? So, and then the financial stressors and all the decisions, there's an awful lot of labor.
What do you do in your business? Because this is what you focus your time on now. And you look like you could be in showbiz.
You
really do have a great look about you.
Thank you.
You look cool, you know.
Well, thank you very much. As somebody who always struggles with image, it's great to be able to receive a compliment like that. And, you know, so what do I do now? Well, I write and I podcast and everything I do and put out into the world. I work with women as well. Is about helping people unlearn these scripts and these beliefs and build the inner resilience to live a life on their own terms and to discover in the process what feels like happiness, you know, what would really make them happy.
And if people, you have a Substack as well. So you're writing there. Mm-hmm. You've got a podcast with Mel Grace.
I have two podcasts. One with my sister Mel. That one is called The Road Back Home. Yes.
And that's going on the road, by the looks of it. It's on the Nina Arts Centre on the 3rd of April.
The Nina Arts Centre on the 3rd of April is a Thursday night. And we are launching our podcast, and it's going to be a live show. It's going to be great crack.
Well, the time has completely run away on me here. So thank you so much for coming and sharing the story.
Thank you so much.
AmandaGrace.ie. Sorry, have I got the red? Yes, AmandaGrace.ie.
That's right.
You'll find your Substack and your podcast
yes,
and all the
indeed.
Details that's going on. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to hear that you're well.
Yes.
If I pass you the street, I think there's a Berlin artist now who knows who knows things about the world.
There you are. Now, there's a woman at peace with herself.
We have to go to a break. Thanks so much. Amanda Grace there.
Now it's visiting critic time. A move over Tupac because we've got Newspac in the room. Brian Dobson is the new rapper extraordinaire. Welcome to the slot, Brian Dobson, first of all. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Oliver. Just fine. Yeah, yeah.
You haven't been in this building, I presume, since...
This is the first time I came back through the gates since May of last year. That's right. Yeah, I think so. I'm trying to think. Have I been? No, I don't think so.
What did that feel like?
It felt just fine. It's great because I'll get to leave again in a little while.
That's the important bit that you get to do. And you cycled in. You used to always cycle to work.
I cycled in. All right. Yeah, I didn't. My wife would correct me here. Because she said, you know, I was a bit of a fair weather. And it's the truth. I was a bit of a fair weather cyclist. You know, on the damp days, I'd get take the car or get a bus, but the cycling's quicker. I mean, if I was coming, I came in here for whatever 10 to 9.
Yeah,
I mean, I'd still be sitting in a car somewhere. So,
and you were prepared for all weather because very gloomy skies.
My leggings and my waterproofs.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I saw you coming in and beautifully polished leather shoes.
Did you like them?
All the wets? Seriously, it's good. I will never complain about. Oh, I can't cycle in those shoes. Ever.
Well, I was never one for the sort of cycling gear. You know, the lycra. You know, and you know those shoes that they wear that go click 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 when people walk. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that attach.
You know, anyway, I wouldn't look great in those tight shorts, you know.
Just use the heel of this leather shoe and kick it off. That's what you do. Life post retirement, is it having a nice time?
Just great. I'm keeping reasonably busy, but not too busy. And I've had a couple of projects which have been interesting and stimulating. I've been doing a documentary. I got roped into a documentary, TV documentary on Ireland's missionary priests and nuns.
Really?
Which was filming sort of towards the end of last year and into this early part of this year.
And is there a specific part of the world you looked at the missions?
Well, we interviewed a lot now of the Irish missionaries are retired and there's very few replacing them. So it's a kind of history. Really, it's called the last Irish missionaries because we're looking now at the last Irish missionaries, really.
Oh, yeah, of course. That would make sense.
So I went out to the Philippines at the end of January to meet a priest called Father Shay Cullen, who's a Columban priest out there who's campaigned for very many years on child protection issues and all of that. And he runs an organisation called Preda, which looks after children.
Still working over there.
Still working. He's in his early 80s and he certainly has no intention of retiring at all.
He's in his early 80s and he's still running that.
He's been there about 50 years. So that was really interesting. It was a quick trip. We went out. I left here on Saturday and was back the following Friday. And it takes about, 20 hours to get to the Philippines. So we spent a lot of time in the air.
I'd say you found extraordinary stories all the way through that whole history.
It is fascinating, because there were, at its height, there were thousands of Irish priests and nuns around the world. And they made a big impact in terms of Ireland's soft power. We interviewed one former Irish ambassador who worked a lot in development in Africa and so on. And he said that, the Americans had the CIA, but we had the Irish missionaries because they could tell you everything that was happening in any particular neck of the woods.
Their
level of understanding, their grasp of all the nuances of the local scene were second to none.
Because a lot of priests, you meet them here who are now retired living back here, but they've been to all sorts of far-flung parts of the world and they have incredible stories.
They do, and we've been hearing some of them. And
one of the interesting things
is that actually quite a few of them said to us when they came back, people weren't terribly interested in hearing what they had to say. You know, they say, how are you, Father? I'm just back from wherever, you know, Nigeria. Oh, that's grand, you know, and, you know, how's the family? And, you know, and they didn't really want to
engage.
It was just curious.
That is curious. But you're breaking that now and you're going to lift it. That was a good project to do. Were you asked to do lots of different things?
No, not particularly. I mean, I had a few people talking to me about podcasts and I got some advice to not, I don't want another job. I've had a job. I'm quite interested in occasional projects. So I've done a few things. I've done some. Now that I don't work in RTE, I can attend events. I can speak at things. I can chair events. I can do all that sort of thing. So I've done a little bit of that.
And you're not doing it for big money. You're doing it for charity a lot of the time.
I do some of it for charity and some of it, yes, if there's remuneration offered. I happily take it,
And what kind of charities are you involved in?
I've had a few involvements and I think it's been important from the point of view of retiring that you do have other things that you're involved in. And I've over the years, in more recent years, I've had a few involvements. So I'm on the board of an organisation called Protestant Aid, which is a little bit like a version of St. Vincent de Paul. It's under the patronage of the Church of Ireland as well. I'm a member of the Church of Ireland. And it issues grants and so on to families in distress and raises money for the most part, I suppose, in the Protestant community. But we also get money from the Department of Social Protection as well. That's distributed through social worker networks and all that kind of thing. So that's I'm engaged in a bit of that. And
does Protestant Aid, it runs nursing homes,
does
it?
It does, and yes, and there's two not-for-profit nursing homes as well. That's right, yeah.
Did anyone offer to publish your memoirs, should you want to write them?
I've had a few chats here and there, but again, I'm just not sure that I have a book in me. I need to sort of think about that.
Quite a lot of people produce books, but not very much.
I'd be terrified of committing to something, and then you get some sort of an advance payment, and then you've got to write this thing. And looking at the page, the blank page every day, trying to produce something.
See.
So I think I said, well, I maybe try and see if I can start something, and if there's something and then another incentive, I suppose, is that you write a little bit about your life for your children and your grandchildren. And we've two grandchildren now, so in years to come, maybe some sort of an account of what their grandparents
did. That feels like a nice
thing
to do as well, doesn't it? Yeah. So you're thinking about it,
but thinking a bit about
you haven't
that,
put pen to paper fingers to keyboards matter. The retirement, though, sounds like a lovely time. Did you prepare for it? Did you know how the day was going to go before you retired?
No, I didn't. As I said, I have some other involvement, so I knew I wouldn't be sitting looking at the four walls wondering how will I fill my day. And most days I have something. I think that's important that you have something to do in the day.
Yes.
And it could be something very, it could be something quite small, but it's a focus for the day. So I try to have that, and that's more or less worked out. When the filming on the documentary ended, I felt little withdrawal symptoms, oddly enough.
Did
I was sort of saying, I don't have an appointment to meet the crew and go and interview somebody or whatever.
Yeah.
So Well, I mean, it's less than a year in, so we'll see.
And you retired slightly early, didn't you? You could have waited another year or so.
I could have gone RTE send you packing at 65. Although I think now they give an extension on a discretionary basis, but I'm 65 in October, so that was my departure date as far as I was concerned. So I went about 18 months early, and I went in May because I think it's a good idea if you're going to do that kind of move. I had a pension in place and everything worked out to do it at the beginning of the summer rather than
That's
the end.
That's a good idea.
Rather than to head into the winter. The winter is more of a challenge.
Difficult
summer
time
is fantastic.
So yeah, an October birthday would mean November, December, January, freshly retired. Did you do a pre-retirement course or anything like that?
I did a pre-retirement course after I retired because I was too busy beforehand. So, and that was very good. RTE send you on that, and your spouse can come with you as well. So Cree and I went along to that, and that was over a couple of days. It was great stuff about health and eating healthy and keeping fit and financial advice. And the man who gave it, who's himself a retired airline pilot, it's the Retirement Council of Ireland and the organisation. They do great work.
Right.
And in his introductory remarks, he said, remember, when you retire typically from the workplace, you lose 80% of your social contacts.
80%?
80%.
My God.
And I forget, he cited whatever study.
That's extraordinary.
But I suppose when you think about it, it makes sense because, I would go into work and I'd have all the colleagues I work with and I meet, and then you'd have all the people I engage with every day as a journalist. You're phoning people, you're interviewing them, you're checking stuff out. So there's all of that going on. Mm-hmm. And that's all gone. So he said, the advice was, he said, there's lots of things you can do in retirement. Stamp collecting is a perfectly respectable hobby, but it doesn't really give you that social engagement that you're missing.
Yes.
So do things that connect you with people.
Very good. Very good advice. I wonder, is that going to change? Because it would be applicable to people who've stayed in the same job for a very long time, wouldn't it? Whereas nowadays, the younger crowd tend to jump from job to job.
Yeah, but they're still having social connection. I suppose it doesn't apply from working remotely. If you're going to be at home all the time, you're
real
going to...
Real downside.
Yeah, that really removes a huge amount of social connection. That's why I personally wouldn't have been interested in working remotely. I mean, I didn't have a long commute or anything like that. And people, I can understand why people are attracted by remote working. But I think it's very just important for our mental health to meet people, to be somewhere, to connect with people. So
have the chat
is the most
important thing.
Yeah.
So that's extraordinary. It does make sense that all your friends are coming from. So you have nice leisurely mornings now. Do you have do you keep
second
a routine?
Cup of tea.
Second cup of tea. <That's lovely. laughs>
I don't really know. I have a routine. No, not particularly.
You're a sailor. You're interested in sailing.
I am.
Is it the season now for sailing?
It's coming up in the next month or so. It'll start getting going again. And I sail with a pal of mine, and we've put our plans in place for the summer. And we'll fingers crossed. The weather wasn't great last summer, so we were
very
a bit
wet,
yeah,
wasn't it?
And windy and
windy.
Yeah,
there's a lot of crossings. Yeah. The Skelligs were cancelled.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know. We went intending to sail around Scotland, and that didn't work out because the weather closed in, so we ended
in the summertime.
Yeah, yeah.
So it usually starts in April.
April, May.
Is there work to be done on the boat?
There's
or
a
the,
bit, yeah.
The yacht?
Is it the yacht? The
yacht. Do you have a yacht, Brian Thompson?
The boat. We'll stick to the boat. Okay. It's a modest little boat that sailing boat, though, I should say.
That's what people with very large yachts say. Modest little boat. But it's a proper sailing.
Oh, it's a proper sailing boat. Yeah, it has an engine because when the wind dies, you do. It's a good type of engine to get you home.
Do you have to physically do all the rope management?
All that pulling the ropes and hauling on the lines and
because I've seen the electric ones. I've seen people.
Oh no, we don't have any of that. No. We're old school. We're old school. And the anchor actually. As well, you know, we have to pull the anchor hand over hand.
Okay, yeah, it's all manual.
So it's all manual. You know, it's a bit of physical exercise.
I was going to say some unpleasant jobs on a boat.
Well, everything on a boat is pleasant, even when it's unpleasant, because you're out on the sea and you're enjoying the nature and the ocean wave.
So you do a nice leisurely sail, or would you be racing?
No, we're on the leisure side of it. I don't do any racing.
How many have to be present on the
3 to 4 is comfortable on our boat because the accommodation is quite tight. It isn't actually that large, mm-hmm. so we can sleep. Four, but you need to get on with each other. You know, you're fairly close quarters. think caravanning on the water. Okay, on the water. You know, that kind of accommodation.
Very nice way to caravan. Would you be sailing through the night as well?
Yes. In fact, night sailing is some of the loveliest sailing you can do on a clear night when the stars are out. It's magical because you're surrounded by darkness.
And if you're traveling with the wind, obviously it feels completely.
Yeah, yeah. And the silence as well. I suppose the silence seems more silent at night as well. And just the sound of the water against the hull, maybe the sails flapping occasionally.
Oh my God, that's the dream. It's the absolute dream.
The moon on the water.
Now we know why you've been such a calm temperament all these years. Because this was your downtime. This was your downtime. We could talk more and more about the stuff you're doing. But look, we want to find out what you get up to because we put you into your discomfort zone. You don't like things like heights and horror movies, I'm told. And a huge surprise, opera. Are you not a fan of opera? I would have thought.
No, and I've got pretty broad musical taste. But opera, I've never managed to get... I've never managed the suspension of disbelief that's necessary.
I just thought a man so urbane as Brian Thompson would be into opera.
No, I haven't tried it very often, but the one or two times I have.
Oh, come on, you might be doing visiting.
It hasn't floated my boat.
So we definitely thought rap music would not be, you're not sitting at home listening to a lot of Kendrick Lamar or Jay-Z.
This was entirely new for me. This was uncharted territory.
Sailing metaphors and everything. Yeah. Okay, so you went. Who did you meet? You went down to Knocknaheeny in Cork to the Cabin Crew Studio.
To the Cabin Crew Studio in Knocknaheeny on the north side of Cork, which is a terrific suburb, just a couple of miles from the centre of Cork City. It's famous as the headquarters of the Apple, Ireland's Apple.
Really, that's where it's based.
So the Cabin Studio is housed in literally a couple of porta cabins, which is where it gets the name. Beside the local secondary school there, Terence McSweeney Community School. And they run rap classes for young primary school, national school students, for teenagers and for adults as well. So I went along on Monday evening and they were having a lesson or a class for the teenagers. And that was followed by the adults. In all, I think they provide classes, if you want to call them that, for about 50 young children across that.
And it's not for profit, it's a community.
No, it's a community. You know. Yeah, it's a community initiative. Yeah, very much. I mean, it's funded by the Music Neighbourhoods is one of the people in Music Network Ireland, I think, as well. So it's...
And the people will know I played a little bit of The Spark at the start, which is the Cabin Crew, with the Listoon Varna crew. You were just with the Cabin Crew.
Yeah.
And they were long listed for a Grammy. So you were in very good company.
Yeah.
What did they ask you to do or what do you...
Well, the way it works is, let me describe the cabin first of all. As I say, it's a couple of porta cabins and you walk into it and there's some sort of studio areas and recording areas. There's some sofas, there's some computers around, there's a little kitchen and everybody's sitting around and they're writing away when I arrived. So the teenagers have been given a theme. Or they've been asked themselves to come up with a word or a theme and then to write a rap on that theme. Right. So I came in, I introduced myself and we started talking about news and they were asked then, well, how about doing a rap about news, something about the news?
That
so that's how
sense.
That kind of sort of started to develop. So I was kind of getting into this as well. So I kind of started playing around with a few ideas and they did. It's a very collaborative exercise. The teenagers did their sort of rap and then the adults arrived. A lot of the adults would be parents maybe of some of the younger, of some of the children who were involved. So, and then we kind of continued this and they did their own raps around news and then I worked on my one and out of it came what I think we're going to hear in a few minutes.
It's called Big News. Who helped you record this?
Well, Gary McCarthy is the artistic director. Gary runs it, and he really is the guy that holds the whole thing together. And Gary brought me back the next morning. We worked on it some more. We refined it some more. What you'll hear is all in one take, as it were, but it wasn't all in one take because I had to stop and start. It's much more difficult than it seems. You think, oh, you're just talking to the music, but you're talking to the beat. Now, on the other hand, it's a great way to express yourself because you don't have to be musical. You don't have to have a singing voice. If you can talk and if you can follow a beat, you can rap. And if you've something to say. So what the essence of rap, and it comes out of hip hop, I think, in the Bronx among African Americans.
I'll bow to your greater judgment on this.
So this is all about doing very thorough research on behalf of the Oliver Callan Show. It's about authenticity. So you're expressing. So it's who you are, and it's kind of interesting because Gary makes the point that it allows the youngsters to have a kind of alter ego. And to express things that maybe they might find difficult to express just in normal conversation or maybe, you know.
The avenue.
Yeah, this is the way you can do it.
And who wrote the masterpiece we're about to listen to?
It's a bit of me, a bit of Gary, a bit of some of the students, a bit of some of the parents. So the
Tiny and MC Bucky were involved.
So we got Tiny and MC Bucky to come back. Yeah. So Tiny who are two of the teenagers.
Yep. Tiny is Darren Stewart, 16-year-old.
Yeah, and Bucky is Aaron Hennessy.
He's 15.
So and both veterans, by the way, of RTE. I think they've both been on the Late Late Toy Show in previous years. So they're well able to stand up and do it. So Gary brought them back in the next morning and asked them to kind of do a little insert into my rap. So you'll hear they appear, or you hear
this
them
the
as well. Again, on the theme of the news.
Describing this, you're even moving with a certain beat.
Well, actually, it's very important. Apparently, it's very important that when you're rapping, you're giving it that sort of physical engagement as well.
Well, without further ado, big news featuring Snoop Dogg, whatever we'll call him, from the cabin. Here we go. Let's enjoy.
Good evening. The main news tonight. I'm back for one show only, but I'm bringing the cabin crew with me.
I bring the big news. It's Dobbo. You gotta fill these big shoes. Passing on the torch to the young crew. They got a good news story, showing you the power and glory. I got a track to do. I'm gonna rap the news. It's the D-O-B-B-O with the cabin crew in Knocknaheeny, and yes, it's so fun. Let's get the news done. It's not the 6-1 in the cabin tonight. It's a beautiful sight, chilling with the crew, and we're spitting some rhymes. The rappers are composing, their talent is showing. They're the big news today, and their sparks are glowing. They rap it out loud, their pain and joy. No matter where they go, they're always making noise. It's got the cabin correspondents standing by. They're right here in the booth, let me pass the mic.
I got some news to write, but I'ma tell you mine. When I'm writing raps, I start to lose track of time. Writing better than ever, you know I'll do this forever. You think I'm stopping them never, these bears are golden like treasure.
Today's top story, what's the crack, son? Channel Tiny never got your back turned, only turned up. That's the way you gotta act, son. Better tune in or back up. The best news in Cork, so you better be engaged.
I bring the big news, it's Dobbo. You gotta fill these big shoes. Passing on the torch to the young crew, they got a good news story, showing you the power and glory. I bring the big news, it's Dobbo, you gotta fill these big shoes. Passing on the torch to the young crew, they got a good news story, showing you the power and glory.
Oh, wow.
That's the news tonight. Thanks for listening.
Big news from Dobbo. I think that deserves a bit of clapping and cheering. Party piece, people. That was Brian Dobson as we'd never heard him before. It sounded like you enjoyed that.
I had a great time.
It's like you were very good, and then when you hear the pro rappers coming in, you're going,
they're in a whole different league.
I love how you kind of change your accent through it. You were
that actually probably is not in the spirit of rap. Because Gary actually makes the point, when people start doing it, they tend to do that because it comes out of American culture, it comes out of the US, so people tend to put on an American accent.
That's right.
But if you listen to Darren and Aaron there, they're
very
in
Cork.
Their Cork accent.
Pure
yeah.
Cork.
So I was kind of trying to work that out of the rap a bit. I mean, some of it just stayed in there. But
you were chilling with the crew, in your own words. Yeah. You should be very proud of yourself. And I believe Tiny and MC Bucky are actually on the line. Good morning to you both.
Yeah.
I'd say hello to Tiny, first of all. That's Darren Stewart, 16 years of age. Good morning, Tiny.
Good morning, gang. What's up?
Oh, that was brilliant. Was that you at the end or was that MC Bucky? I can't really
tell. That was me at the end, yeah.
Oh, fair play to you. You're 16. What are you up to in your life, Darren?
I'm just chilling. I'm in TY at the moment. I'm just chilling up in the Sean Mavalia in school because I just got done Irish class, so I'm kind of in between classes right now doing this interview, so it's pretty chill, you know.
Not
major, like, you know.
Actually, geez, when I was young, it used to be called TYO, which we called Total Year Off. But but transition, it's really good because you get to step out and do these kind of things that you can focus your art on.
Yeah, man, it's so chill. Like, I've just been doing nothing but working on, like, movies and, like music the whole year. Like,
what movie did you work on?
Last year, well, I know I wasn't in TY last year, but I was in a movie directed by Brendan Canty called Christie.
Oh.
So that's interesting.
I thought you were going to say, like, a movie that you just did in TY, but no, this is a real thing.
Oh, no. Yeah, like an actual movie production, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, that's tiny. MC Bucky's on the line as well. Good morning.
What's the story?
This is Aaron Hennessy. And you're what age, Aaron?
I'm 15.
15 years of age. And so that means you're what, junior cert?
Yeah, I'm in junior cert.
Studying hard?
A fair bit.
Just pretend, say yes when you're in the radio. It's grand.
Yeah.
Come here. What did you make, MC Bucky, of Big News starring Snoop Dogg?
I think it was actually very fun to make. Brian's obviously a sound. He's very sound. He's dead sound.
Oh, yeah.
And, it was just a fun track to make.
I think you've kind of changed his life. I've never seen him so chill. Tiny, you were very impressed by a debut performer.
Oh, yeah. He's an absolute natural. Fair play to him.
Thanks, lads. That's very kind.
He's not going to take any compliments, but he's properly
chuffed.
You got on with the lads, lovely.
They were fantastic. I mean, it took me, like, from the previous night to the next day and working with a lot of other people to produce the script, if you like, of that, or the words. But Darren and Aaron, they came across from school. Gary gave them the sort of general thing, do something on news. They went off for about 10 or 15 minutes, I think. Was it, lads? You weren't gone very long. Back they come with what you heard there.
As
and
quick
they
as that.
Recorded straight away and it's done. And
genius. Absolutely genius. And come here, lads. You probably, given your age, we don't expect you to be watching the news. Had you watched the news? Were you familiar with the legend that is Dobbo?
My mom told me about my parents and stuff.
It's always the parents, isn't it?
That's fine. We'll take that.
Yeah, sorry, MC Bucky, you were going to say something there.
Yeah, my mum told me about it. First of all, I didn't know, because I didn't watch the news, but then my mum was like telling me.
You don't watch the news in general?
No.
How do you find out what's going on in the world then?
TikTok.
Oh no, that's all the answers. Is it the same for you, Tiny?
I'd see news channels on social media, like, so it's kind of the same thing.
Yes. I think that's actually a good point, that it's TikTok, but it could be RT News.
Could be, exactly.
And that's exactly.
You're on social media, aren't you, Oliver? This is going to be...
I am. Yeah. I'm at the time. Not very strong. But listen, we better let you get back to a very busy TY day, Tiny. But thanks a million. And also to MC Bucky there as well, Aaron Hennessy and Darren
Stewart. Can I just thank the lads for taking part in this. It was great to meet them. Great to meet all the cabin crew in Knocknaheeny. It was a real delight, and I couldn't have been made more welcome and felt more at home, and it was just a terrific visit overall, and I hope I'll be able to get back sometime soon. So thanks, Darren. Thanks, Aaron.
Hopefully, man. Lovely meeting you.
Likewise, good luck, lads. And that's a massive thumbs up, really, for the stuff the cabin crew do. They're both
fantastic.
The whole cabin crew are Grand Marshals in the St. Patrick's Day parade in Cork as well.
Can I give a shout out for the adult class?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's
because they kind of worked a lot with me to get this together. And that's Jackie, James, Nicola Marie, Ellen, Sally, Adrian, Alex, who are father and son, Noel, Joe, and Rory. And I couldn't have done without them.
That's the song project.
That's it. That's what we're called.
That's what it's called. Yeah. The song project. Yeah. Well, Brian Dobson, absolute pleasure chatting to you.
There's lovely
messages here. Please, Brian Dobson for president, the most eligible person for the post, says Maureen in Cork. Dobbo for president, says another one. You see, everybody now who goes before Mike. You've turned down the podcast.
I don't want another job.
He's ruled himself out of Horse and Hooked Run. Great to hear Brian Dobson on the radio, wishing him continued success in his projects, wishing him many more blessings of health and happiness.
Oh,
one of our veterans in radio and on RT News every you blessings, says Yvonne and Alex from Waterford.
That's very kind.
So
thank
lovely
you.
Lovely messages. And St. Patrick's weekend, you St. Patrick's Cathedral is where you go to your church
I do,
services.
Yes. I won't be there because we're going to visit some friends of ours.
Ah, you're going to
away. Yes.
Happy St. Patrick's
and
weekend.
And a very happy St. Patrick's
to you and the family.
To you, Oliver, and to all your listeners.
And if there is a book, we look forward to welcoming you back.
I'll be back to plug it.
You might be back to review opera. Thank you. That's Brian Dobson. Back with our party piece people after these. Pop us an email anytime at all. Oliver@rte.ie. Happy St. Patrick's weekend to you all. Agus slán.